It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. And for us, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha lived in India, and then Bodhidharma brought the teachings from India to China, and then Dogen brought the teachings from China to Japan, and then my teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, greatly indebted himself to Dogen, and myself and many others in the Soto Zen lineage bring it to the West. And it's very profound. It's very profound, actually. So last week, we left off with Siddhartha, the Buddha's name before he was the Buddha, with his wife's Yasodhara, with her help, leaving the palace in order to put an end to the suffering of impermanence. I mean, just imagine that, to try to put an end to the suffering of impermanence. The truth that every being must endure the hardships of sickness, aging, and death were, he found, intolerable. So to this end, he set out to learn from the wise spiritual seekers that he'd heard about. But after studying with them, he didn't find an answer. He wasn't satisfied. And finally, he joined a group of five ascetics who were very strict, and they sat a lot. But after 6 years, he was emaciated and exhausted, and also unsatisfied. So Thich Nhat Hanh, those of you who weren't here last week, and just to remind everybody, I'm using Thich Nhat Hanh's very well-researched, but tale-like, a version of the story of the Buddha and how his teachings evolved. I'm using Thich Nhat Hanh's story for whenever I'm going to reference something in a story form. And here's one. The first one today will be Thich Nhat Hanh telling us in the little girl Sujata's words what happened next. So we have the Buddha, we have Siddhartha exhausted and emaciated. And so then Sujata told Savasti, another child, how she first met Siddhartha several months earlier and how she had since brought him food every day around noon. It was on a full moon day. At her mother's request, she had put on a new pink sari and carried a platter of food to offer to the forest gods. There were cakes, milk, congee, and honey. The noon sun blazed. And as Sujata neared the river, she saw a man lying unconscious on the road. She put down her platter and ran to him. He was barely breathing and his eyes were tightly closed. His cheeks had the sunken look of someone who had not had food for a long time. From his long hair, tangled beard, and ragged garment, Sujata knew he was a mountain ascetic who must have fainted from hunger. So without hesitating, she poured a cup of milk and eased it against the man's lips, spilling a few drops on them. At first, he did not respond, but then his lips quivered and parted slightly. Sujata slowly poured milk into his mouth, and he began to drink and before long, the cup was empty. Sujata then sat along the riverbank to see if the man would regain consciousness. Slowly, he sat up and opened his eyes. Seeing Sujata, he smiled. He pulled the end of his garment back over his shoulder and folded his legs in a lotus position. He began to breathe, first shallowly and then more deeply. His sitting was stable and beautiful. Thinking that he must be a mountain god, Sujata joined her palms and began to prostrate herself before him, but the man motioned for her to stop. Sujata sat up and the man spoke to her in a soft voice, "Child, please pour me a little more milk." Happy to hear him speak, Sujata poured another cup and he drank it all. He felt how truly nourishing it was. Less than an hour before, he thought he was about to breathe his last. Now his eyes shone and he smiled gently. Sujata asked him how he had fainted on the road. "I have been practicing meditation in the mountains. Harsh ascetic discipline has left my body weak. So today I decided to walk down to the village to beg for some food. But I lost all my strength getting here. Thanks to you, my life has been saved." They sat along the riverbank together and the man told Sujata about himself. He was Siddhartha, the son of a king who reigned over the country of the Sakya clan. Sujata listened carefully as Siddhartha told her, "I have seen that abusing the body cannot help one find peace or understanding. The body is not just an instrument. It's the temple of the spirit, the raft by which we cross to the other shore. I will no longer practice self-mortification. I will go to the village each morning to beg for food." Sujata joined her palms. "Honorable hermit, if you allow me, I will bring you food each day. There is no need for you to interrupt your meditation practice. My home is not far from here, and I know my parents would be happy for me to bring you your meal." Siddhartha was silent for a moment, then he answered, "I am glad to accept your offer, but from time to time, I would also like to go into the village to beg in order to meet the villagers. I would like to meet your parents and other children in the village as well." Sujata pointed out the Dangsiri Mountain, where Siddhartha pointed out the Dangsiri Mountain, where he had lived in the caves. "Beginning today, I will not return there. This forest is cool and refreshing. There is a magnificent papala tree, which I shall make a place of my practice. Tomorrow, when you come with the food offering, please bring it there. Come, I will show you the spot." Siddhartha led Sujata across the river into the cool forest that bordered the other bank of the Niranjara River. He showed her the papala tree under which he would meditate. Sujata admired its massive trunk and raised her head to gaze at the leafy branches, which spread out like an enormous canopy. It was a kind of banyan tree with leaves shaped like hearts, with long pointed tails. The leaves were as big as Sujata's hand. She listened to the birds chirping happily among the branches. It was truly a peaceful and refreshing spot. In fact, she had been to this tree before with her parents to make food offerings to the forest gods. "This is your new home, teacher." Sujata looked at Siddhartha with her round black eyes. "I will visit you here every day." Siddhartha nodded. He walked Sujata back out of the forest and said goodbye to her at the riverbank. Then he returned alone to the papala tree. So So here's an excerpt from the time that Siddhartha sat beneath the papala tree just before his awakening. And I just want to say, you're going to hear now some basic premises in Buddhism. And just to remind you that Buddhism is not about the intellect. These tenets that you're about to hear that Buddha discovered as he sat before his awakening, you will understand them through your own Zazen practice. They're understood through your body. I just tell you this so that you don't think like, oh, this is, you don't get sort of fuzzy headed over all these ideas and think, oh my God, I just am never going to understand this. Or maybe not, maybe you won't have that experience. But anyway, here's what the Buddha experienced as he sat under the papala tree. He smiled and looked up at the a papala leaf imprinted against the blue sky, its tail blowing back and forth as if calling him. Looking deeply at the leaf, he saw clearly the presence of the sun and stars. Without the sun, without light and warmth, the leaf could not exist. This was like this because that was like that. He also saw in the leaf the presence of clouds. Without clouds, there could be no rain, and without rain, the leaf could not be. He saw the earth, time, space, and mind, all were present in the leaf. In fact, at that very moment, the entire universe existed in that leaf. The reality of the leaf was a wondrous miracle. So because of his sitting and his open, spacious mind, he could see how everything affects everything else, that everything needs everything else to exist. This was like this because that was like that. That expression of reality he saw for the first time. So, though we ordinarily think that a leaf is born in the springtime, Gotama could see that it had been there for a long, long time in the sunlight, the clouds, the tree, and in himself. Seeing that the leaf had never been born, he could see that he too had never been born. Both the leaf and he himself had simply manifested. They had never been born and were incapable of ever dying. With this insight, ideas of birth and death, appearance and disappearance dissolved, and the true face of the leaf and his own true face revealed themselves. He could see that the presence of any one phenomena made possible the existence of all other phenomena. One included all, and all were contained in one. So just to comment, this idea that both the leaf and he himself had simply manifested, that they had never been born and were incapable of ever dying, a good image, at least for me, that helps me to understand this is the sky with clouds that come and go, manifesting themselves and manifesting themselves all within the sky continuously. The sea and its waves is another one. One includes all. Nothing exists alone on its own power. That's kind of the point. So back to Thich Nhat Hanh. The leaf and his body were one. neither possessed a separate permanent self, neither could exist independently from the rest of the universe. Seeing all interdependent nature of all phenomena, Siddhartha saw the empty nature of all phenomena, that all things are empty of a separate, isolated self. He realized that the key to liberation lay in these two principles of interdependence and non-self. So these two principles, interdependence, that everything relies on everything else, so there's a constant fluctuation, and no separate self, that we don't exist in the way we think we exist, are basic principles in Zen Buddhism. Clouds drifted across the sky, forming a white background in the translucent papala leaf. Perhaps that evening, the clouds would encounter a cold front and transform into rain. Clouds were one manifestation, rain was another. Clouds also were not born and would not die. If the clouds understood that, Gautama thought, surely they would sing joyfully as they fell down as rain onto the mountains, forests, and rice fields. Siddhartha now understood that impermanence and emptiness of self are the very conditions necessary for life. Without impermanence and emptiness of self, nothing could grow or develop. If a grain of rice did not have the nature of impermanence and emptiness of self, it could not grow into a rice plant. If clouds were not empty of self and impermanent, they could not transform into rain. Without an impermanent, non-self nature, a child could never grow into an adult. So do you see, impermanence and emptiness of self are the very conditions necessary for life. If a rice grain were impermanent, it couldn't change. Were permanent. If it were just like itself and it would never change, then it can't change. It can't grow and change into something else. And the same with we human beings. Thus, he thought, to accept life means to accept impermanence and emptiness of self. The source of suffering is a false belief in permanence and the existence of separate selves. Reb Anderson Roshi says that our belief in a separate self is the single greatest disaster of mankind. Just saying. So seeing this, one understands that there is neither birth nor death, production nor destruction, one nor many, inner nor outer, large nor small, impure nor pure, all such concepts are false distinctions created by the intellect. If one penetrates into the empty nature of all things, one will transcend all mental barriers and be liberated from the cycle of suffering. So basically, it's our mind and the strong belief in what our mind is telling us that prevents us from seeing reality. Actually, according to Sawaki Roshi, the mind is just secreting thoughts. We just secrete thoughts. And it's like a machine. The mind's a machine of secreting thoughts. So we don't need to hold on to them. Letting our thoughts go, in fact, is the practice of Zazen. That's what we do in Zazen. We let our thoughts go. So from one night to the next, Gotama meditated beneath the papaya tree, shining the light of his awareness on his body, his mind, and all the universe. His five companions had long abandoned him, and his co-practitioners were now the forest, the river, the birds, and thousands of insects living on the earth and in the trees. The great papaya tree was his brother in practice. The evening star, which appeared as he sat down in meditation each night, was also his brother in practice. He meditated far into the night, and finally, along with the morning star, the great earth, and all beings, he awakened. I talked about this last week, actually, but after the Buddha attained enlightenment, he decided he wouldn't teach because he figured that what he had seen was too subtle for people to understand. No one would believe him. So the story goes that as soon as the thought of the Buddha, had reached the mythological realms, very quickly and spontaneously, the Brahma Sahampati, the most senior of the Maha deities, became very concerned for the world. He appeared before the Buddha and encouraged the Buddha to teach. Brahma Sahampati said to the Buddha, "Venerable sir, let the Blessed One teach the Dharma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dharma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are perishing through not hearing the Dharma. There will be those who will understand the Dharma." On hearing this, the Buddha changed his mind and began to search for someone to teach. So he thought, to whom should I first teach the Dharma? Who will understand this Dharma quickly? And then it occurred to him that Alara Kalama, one of his previous teachers, could understand. And the deities heard this and said, Alara Kalama died 7 days ago. So the Buddha thought, oh, what a loss. And contemplating again who could understand, he thought about Udaka Ramaputta, another former teacher. But the deity told him that Udaka Ramaputta had died during the night. That's strange, the Buddha thought again, but then he thought perhaps the five ascetics, the five monks with whom he had practiced austerities, could probably hear his new teaching. So he set out for Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. That location is very famous, Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. So finally he saw that he was approaching the five monks, and the monks saw him coming and agreed among themselves, "Friends, here comes the ascetic Gotama who lives luxuriously, who gave up his striving and reverted to luxury. We should not pay homage to him or rise up to him or receive his bowl or outer robe. But a seat may be prepared for him. If he likes, he may sit down." However, as he approached, they found they could not keep up their pact. One took his bowl and outer robe, another prepared a seat, and another set out water for his feet, and they called the Buddha friend. The Buddha said, "You can't call me friend because I am the Tathagata." Tathagata means thus perfected one, the one who on the way of truth has attained supreme enlightenment. That's what Tathagata means. So you can't call me friend because I am the Tathagata and have attained the truth. Monks, do not address the Tathagata by name and as friend. I shall teach you the Dharma. The Tathagata has not reverted to luxury, nor has he given up his striving. The Tathagata has achieved the enlightenment and can teach you and practice with you. And so the five monks and the Tathagata began to live together simply. So this is different from before, where they didn't live, they lived together, you know, like on a grain of life of rice a day or something like that. So now they're living simply, they're begging for food and listening to the teaching. And as the story goes, soon the five monks achieved unshakable liberation. So they too became enlightened. So this teaching that the Buddha gave to the five monks is called the First Discourse on the Four Noble Truths. But the Tathagata's Four Noble Truths Sutra, sutra means a discourse that the Buddha gave. And there are many sutras, and they're kind of the exact, so to speak, they're the precise, Ananda, who had a photographic mind, memory, repeated all of the discourses of the Buddha to others. And so that's how the sutras were transported. But I'm just saying that a sutra means the words of the Buddha as he, it's like a Dharma talk only by the Buddha. So it's called a teisho, or a discourse. So this first talk, this is the first discourse of the Buddha, the first sutra, and it's on the Four Noble Truths. But before he gave that talk, he explained the two truths, the difference between conventional truth and ultimate truth. And that's called the middle way. And it states that the ultimate truth, our absolute truth, which is emptiness, and the relative truth, which is the reality of just what we see, phenomenal things, and actually they're the same and they're both empty. The Nagarjuna is a second to third century Buddhist philosopher, and this is how he puts that particular teaching that's like critical. So there are four verses of like one line each. In the verse 8, this is Nagarjunan. You'll hear his name often. The teaching of the Dharma by the various Buddhas is based on the two truths, namely the relative or worldly truth and the absolute or supreme truth. And this, verse 9, the next verse, those who do not know the distinction between the two truths cannot understand the profound nature of the Buddha's teaching. Without relying on everyday common practices, the relative truths, the absolute truth cannot be expressed. So the absolute truth is expressed through the relative truth. Without understanding absolute truth, nirvana cannot be attained. So there's a connection. We have our relative truth, you know, as we cook our breakfast. And through that relative truth, absolute truth can be understood. And then through absolute truth, nirvana can be attained. We declare, this is Nagarjuna says, we declare that whatever is relational is relative truth, basically is sunyata, which is absolute truth. Sunyata is a provisional name for the mutuality of being, in other words, interdependence. And indeed, it is the middle path. So he's basically saying interdependence is the middle way. It's the middle way between the absolute and the relative is interdependence. Sunyata, or emptiness, is how all phenomenal things are. And don't forget, emptiness means empty of an independent self. That's all emptiness means, empty of independent self. Nagarjuna uses the word provisional names or thought constructs as a term for all phenomena. So all phenomena are just thought constructs. In other words, phenomenal things being empty of inherent individual existence are constructs of our minds. He says the relativity of all beings, their interdependence, is itself the ultimate truth and the middle way. So this idea that what we see as reality is a construct of our thoughts is revolutionary and a basic premise of Buddhism, and especially Zen. And it's the foundation of Zazen, as we will see. So first the Buddha corrected what he called the two extremes, pursuing happiness through sensual pleasure with no thought of any spiritual discipline, and the severe spiritual discipline to the point of self-mortification. Neither led him to enlightenment, and the Buddha's life is an example of the journey between the two. He lived in the palace, which was an extreme sensual existence with no thought of a spiritual life. And then he lived on, a grain of rice a day, let's say. And after 6 years, he had it, and he found that the only path was through what he called the middle way, and which he summarized in his first teaching in the form of the fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path. So on a deeper level, the middle way is both the middle way between pleasure and self-mortification, but it's also philosophically, it's the middle way between conventional truth and ultimate truth, which are both empty. So the first noble truth is simply that there is suffering in the world, a constant stream of dissatisfaction. First noble truth is there is suffering in the world. We just accept that truth. There is suffering. The first noble truth is suffering. Yes, there is suffering. The second noble truth is that suffering is caused by our desires, attachments, and clinging. And basically, this is karma, actually. But our desires, attachments, and clinging is another way to put it. That's what causes suffering. So the first noble truth is suffering, and the second noble truth is the cause of suffering. The third noble truth is that there's cessation of suffering. And that is through, so that the third noble truth just says we can have liberation from suffering. And the fourth noble truth is, here's how we can have liberation from suffering. And it's described in what's called the Eightfold Noble Path. So let me go over this again. It's really simple. One, there's suffering, which a lot of people don't want to admit this. They go, what? Suffering? We don't suffer. Everything is perfect. So there is suffering. Number two, this is what causes suffering: desires, clinging, and attachment. Number three, suffering can end. We can end suffering. Number four, here's how to end suffering, which is the Eightfold Noble Path. So within the Four Noble Truths, we have the Eightfold Path. Someone last week asked the question, where does the Eightfold Noble Path fit into the Four Noble Truths? And this is how. It's the fourth noble truth. Next week, we'll study the Four Noble Truths as a whole. And after that, every single week, we'll take one at a time each one of the Eightfold Paths. So we're going to cover all of this very thoroughly. I needed to give you a feeling of how it came about, though, how the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path that we're going to spend quite a bit of time on what's the derivation of it? And that's why I kind of took two talks to really sink into, you know, this is what the Buddha went through in the palace and how he became increasingly dissatisfied. And then he was so dissatisfied, he decided that he was going to find a solution to this. And he did. He found a solution to suffering. And that's what Buddhism is all about. The solution to the great matter, as they call it, the great, we need to clarify the great matter of life and death. That's how Dogen put it to himself when he went to China. I need to clarify the great matter of life and death. And then when he found finally at the very end of his 4 years in China, so he didn't find it in Japan. He found a teacher, Myo Zen, that was very good, but not complete. He also did not have the complete answer. The two of them traveled to China. And finally, at the very end of his stay in China, Buddha found Ru Jing, his precious Zen master. And Ru Jing was a Chinese Soto Zen master and passed on the Dharma to Dogen. And then Dogen took it to Japan and began teaching. And his first teaching was called the Fukan Zazenji, which is his teaching on Zazen. And we might have a series on that. I'm thinking how to do it. So I just want to finish by saying that the Dalai Lama says that the benefit of studying the Four Noble Truths is that we all have a wish to have happiness and avoid suffering. And the Dalai Lama says that this wish is not the result of training, education, or culture. It is innate. This wish to have happiness and avoid suffering, the wish of Siddhartha before he attained enlightenment, he went to seek enlightenment because of his wish to have happiness and avoid suffering. The Dalai Lama says, if we are truly mindful, we will definitely see that we have an instinctive wish to enhance our happiness and reduce our difficulties in some way. Through mindfulness, we can glimpse this instinctive wish to have happiness and avoid suffering while it is arising. And furthermore, he says, we can go farther if we recognize that regardless of superficial differences, down deep, all beings possess the same instinctive feeling. At this deepest level, there is complete equality among all sentient beings. The Dalai Lama feels that understanding this understanding is fundamental if we truly want to help others. The feeling that we are every single sentient being, regardless of superficial differences, deep down, all possess the same instinctive feeling of wanting happiness and to avoid suffering. So this is very profound. I'm going to go over again five of those what Siddhartha saw in his process of sitting under the papala tree, we call it the Bodhi tree, as he was about to attain enlightenment, he saw first that we ordinarily, though we ordinarily think that a leaf is born in the springtime, he could see that it had been there for a long, long time in the sunlight, the clouds, and the tree, and in himself. Seeing that the leaf had never been born, he could see that he too had never been born. Both the leaf and he himself had simply manifested. They had never been born and were incapable of ever dying. And for me, when I think of clouds in the sky, I can get a feeling for this. Secondly, upon awakening, the Buddha realized that the sea and his body, that the leaf and his body were one, neither possessed a separate permanent self. Neither could exist independently from the rest of the universe. Third, seeing the interdependent nature of all phenomena, Siddhartha saw the empty nature of all phenomena, that all things are empty of a separate, isolated self. He realized that the key to liberation lay in these two principles of interdependence and non-self. Fourth, the Buddha upon awakening realized that without impermanence and emptiness of self, nothing could grow or develop. If a grain of rice did not have the nature of impermanence and emptiness of self, it could not grow into a rice plant. If clouds were not empty of self and impermanent, they could not transform into rain. Without an impermanent, non-self nature, a child could never grow into an adult. Thus, he thought, to accept life means to accept impermanence and the emptiness of self. And the last, Nagarjuna says that the relativity of all beings is itself, that in itself is the ultimate truth and the middle way. In other words, conventional truth and ultimate truth are the same and both empty, but we can't know that through our intellect. We know that through our body and through Zazen practice. All of these things are known through our Zazen practice. But it's useful, you know, to use our minds as a tool. So even though I asked you to reflect on certain things during the week, at the same time that I asked you to reflect on things during the week, I know that the way to understand every single one of these things that I talked about today is with your body in Zazen. And so it's like Suzuki Roshi said, not always so. It's not always that you learn it, you kind of struggle to grasp these things with your head, and then you find out, you know, it's not with your head that you're going to get these things really. It's with your body. But getting them with your head helps. So here are some ideas that I would like you to reflect upon during the week. Not because I like you to reflect upon them, but these reflecting upon the ideas I'm going to give you help you to integrate all of this stuff. You know, this is a big deal, kind of, Buddhism is a big deal. I mean, it just really is. Especially Zen Buddhism. It's very precious. It's extremely precious. And giving you these little ways to reflect on the teachings will help you absorb them. So I hope that you do reflect on the following five things. First, in your own words, describe how the teachings of impermanence, emptiness of self or interdependency, and karma, cause and effect. Karma means cause and effect, or this is this because that is that. They all fit together and are saying the same things. Try to work this out until you understand, like actually you have an aha moment. So the three things are impermanence, interdependency, and this is this because that is that, our karma. Whichever words are most useful to you. How they're all the same. They fit together and they're all the same. But if you can like, oh, I see, that'll help you. And by the way, we're posting these things so that you can review them. Secondly, how do you understand the middle way? And at what points in your life do you struggle with it? Another way of putting this is, at what points in your life do you feel that you do practice the middle way? And at what points do you fail to practice it? And when I say middle way here, I'm using the conventional truth middle way, you know, between extremes. And thirdly, the Dalai Lama says that through mindfulness, we can glimpse this instinctive wish to have happiness and avoid suffering while it is arising. We can be aware of it through mindfulness practice. We can see it bubble up and try to catch yourself glimpsing this. Try to catch yourself. What were you doing and what were you thinking? That's the third thing I'd like you to reflect upon. And the fourth is, of the many stories that were told today, which was the most meaningful to you? And what part of it especially was the most moving? And fifth, Siddhartha saw that the clouds were not born and will not die. And if the clouds understood, he thought, surely they would sing joyfully as they fell down as rain onto the mountains, forests, and rice fields. Do you understand? Why would the clouds be joyful to discover their own impermanence? Just that. Why would the clouds be joyful to discover their own impermanence? A question came in last week after I left, and I'd like to answer it now. And the question was, can we lose our Dharma? Dharma means truth. Dharma is the truth. So everything is Dharma. And everything, because of impermanence, a million times a second changes everything. You know, your own body, everything. You can see it right in front of your eyes. We do not own anything, and we cannot possess anything. So you are Dharma. You're Dharma. And can you lose yourself? And yes is the answer. But right now, right here, or this, just this, like stop and say that to yourself. You, one of the two of them, like right now, right here, is like a reminder. Or I like this, just this. I say that to myself a lot. If I'm getting impatient, just this, Gail, this, just this. They're good ways to experience your life fully from minute to minute. So everything is changing as we speak. But if you go this, just this, it will help you stay as present as possible with with your life's experience. So the question, can we lose our Dharma? No, we can't lose anything. So you can't lose yourself and your Dharma. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. So we have a question. So whoever asked, they started with not a question, but a comment. I'm a little disappointed that when the Buddha was wondering who he could teach the Dharma to, that he didn't immediately think of the little girl. She seems like she would have been very open to this teaching.
You know, you're right. And I left that out of the story because of time, actually. I needed to tell you about the Four Noble Truths. And so you are absolutely right. The Buddha's very first teaching was to the children, and he called the children together, all of them, and they came and they brought one of them, or somehow they all had a tangerine. They all had a tangerine, and the first teaching was on mindfulness as they together, each of them took their tangerine and they peeled it, and then they ate their tangerines mindfully. And the Buddha gave them a lesson on mindfulness. And that was his very first teaching, was to the children, each having a tangerine all together and silently eating their tangerine with mindfulness. And that was the Buddha's very first teaching. And I was going to tell you that, but I didn't think there would be time, and I needed to get to the Four Noble Truths. So I'm really glad you asked that question, because that to me, that should have been on the record. Like, that's the very first teaching was on mindfulness as you eat a tangerine. And then the Four Noble Truths was the second teaching. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Gail. So the second question that we have is, the middle way sounds like a compromise. You can't realize the ultimate truth, so try this. Isn't that a limiting concept?
No, I don't think so. Let me think for a second. No, I don't think so, but let me think why for a second. you know, the ultimate truth, which is enlightenment, basically, cannot be had through the intellect. And we need to live, we need to live a way that's closest to our authentic self as possible, so that we're like a vessel that can receive enlightenment. The truth is, let me put it in different words. We already have enlightenment. So Trungpa Rinpoche calls it the enlightenment gene. We all have the enlightenment gene, and another word for it is Buddha nature. We all have Buddha nature. And so the problem is that it's just kind of like sitting there. We don't do zazen in order to attain enlightenment. We do zazen in order to express our already enlightened nature, already our Buddha nature, which is the middle way. So we do zazen to express our middle way nature, our enlightened nature, and that's all. So in a way, that's why it's said that zazen and enlightenment are the same. So we're taught all the time zazen and enlightenment are the same, which is why zazen is not a meditation technique. There are many meditation techniques, and zazen is not one of them. Zazen is its own thing. Zazen is zazen and nothing else. Zazen is zazen, and we do not do it to attain anything. We just do it for nothing, and then we become nothing. And in the end, maybe enlightenment is nothing. That's the answer, and I think that's the end of our time. And so I want to be sure to thank my team, Sahar and Brian and Brendan, for their very hard work, all of them, to make these talks possible. I'm so grateful. Thank you very much, and I'll see you next week.